NPR.
This is The Indicator from Planet Money. I'm Weilin Wong.
And I'm Adrian Ma. Here on the show, we love econ vocab. You know, these are nerdy terms that aren't used much outside the econ world. So learning what they mean is like getting access to a kind of secret language that helps us understand the economy better.
And sometimes these specialized terms make the leap from academic circles into everyday language. That's when they get maybe the highest honor that a humble little vocab word can ever hope to achieve. They get added to the dictionary.
That is right. Earlier this month, Merriam-Webster added over 300 new words to the dictionary. And we were pretty excited because a bunch of these words are econ vocab terms, terms that we have talked about on The Indicator before, like metaverse, unbanked, shrinkflation, and supply chain.
There were some other business terms on the list, too. One that I really liked is dumb phone, you know, like a non-smartphone.
That's a business term.
Yeah. Today on the show, we pull back the curtain on how words make it into the dictionary. And we meet the economist who's credited with coining one of these new additions.
To get kind of meta about things, a word added to the dictionary is sort of like a lagging indicator. In economics, a lagging indicator measures something that's already happened. And in the same way, the dictionary captures words that have already entered the mainstream.
If a word is new and then grows into the broader journalism, that's when we put it into the dictionary. So we're looking at the language in the rearview mirror in a way. And that will be a new word for many generalists, but an old word for many specialists. You know, and if that's true, then I think we've got it just about right.
Peter Sokolowski is editor at large at Merriam-Webster, and he thinks of words as traveling on a conveyor belt from obscurity to mainstream usage. Editors like Peter are often there at the beginning of the process, observing when a word first starts popping up.
We might notice it when the word is still being treated with what I call linguistic white gloves. If you always put a parenthesis after and explain, or even in quotation marks, that kind of thing announces to the reader, this is a term that you may not be exposed to up until this moment.
As you can probably guess, Peter's job involves a ton of reading. And in the pre-digital age, this would literally mean, for instance, he would spend an hour doing R&M, which stands for reading and marking. Basically, combing through different publications to look for interesting words.
And the staffers would divvy up the reading. So Peter and his colleagues, they would subscribe to law journals, scientific journals, newspapers from around the country, and magazines, everything from People to The Wine Advocate.
We want to see everything. We would read soup can labels and restaurant menus because that's language that the public encounters, right? So it makes sense to find the language that's used on the labels of, for example, breakfast cereal, and to say, hey, do we cover that sense of delicious, you know, in the dictionary? So we just kind of observe everything and bring it all back and collect it.
Wow, it must take forever for this guy to go shopping.
Because he's just reading everything. It's like taking every box down from the shelf.
It's like, okay, now I need some peanut butter. First ingredient, peanuts. Okay, I believe we've used this one before. Second ingredient.
Partially hydrogenated vegetable oil.
Let me check. That is also in the dictionary. Okay.
Now, this process of collecting interesting words out in the world used to be a really manual process. Editors like Peter would mark a paragraph that had a new word or a new usage of an existing word. Then a dedicated staff of typists would enter this information on little slips of paper that would get filed alphabetically.
Merriam-Webster doesn't print these physical slips of paper anymore. But if you go to the Merriam-Webster headquarters in Springfield, Massachusetts, walk up to the second floor, you will find metal filing cabinets filled with 16 million individual slips of paper.
Do you ever go into the file room and just open a random drawer and read the things for fun?
I'm embarrassed to say we sometimes open the file drawers just to kind of hold our coffee or something, you know.
Can you imagine being the one that like spills on these like irreplaceable hand-typed cards from like 1922.
Truly, there's an atmosphere of reverence here in the cabinet room. But seriously, this treasure trove of citations is still what dictionary editors refer to when they're updating definitions or deciding if a new word should get added. And it's not so much about hitting a specific number of instances as it is about making a professional judgment call. Like, does a word feel like a term that a lot of people know and use in a consistent way.
We have more and more and more evidence of each word as the years go by. And then we can see maybe this year this word is ready. It has met the criteria for entry, which is to say long-term use and widespread use and meaningful use. And by that, I mean that over a period of time, a large number of publications have used the word to mean the same thing.
This process where a word goes from specialized to general usage moves at different speeds. You can see the range in two of the econ vocab terms that got added to Merriam-Webster in September, supply chain and shrinkflation. Merriam-Webster dates the term supply chain to 1948. But then, of course, usage exploded during the pandemic. So that's an example of like a jargony word that kicked around for a long time before entering the mainstream.
Then you got words that catch on a lot quicker, like shrinkflation, which, by the way, is a kind of inflation where the cost of stuff remains the same, but you get less of it. Merriam-Webster dates the first known usage of shrinkflation to 2013, and it says the economist Pippa Malmgren is often given credit for coining it.
I noticed things were shrinking in their packages. So there were fewer potato chips in a bag. There were smaller candy bars. And I'm like, wait a minute, what is that? And I had to make up a word for it because there wasn't a word at the time. And so I called it shrinkflation. And then it just accelerated like crazy.
As an economic advisor, Pippa has worked with corporate CEOs and government leaders. And she says even heads of state get annoyed when shrinkflation comes for their candy.
Oh, yeah, they all notice. What's amazing to me is of all the different examples that I could come up with, the one that gets everyone completely outraged are chocolate bars. That's the one they're like, don't mess with my chocolate bar.
Pippa says what she did was put a catchy name to something in the economy people sensed was happening, but they had a hard time discussing because there was no term for it. Now she's pretty tickled at how this word has taken off.
Somebody told me, they were like, you know, there's a Wikipedia entry for your word. I was like, what? That's so cool.
And now it's in Merriam-Webster officially, like the dictionary.
It's fantastic. And I really encourage everybody to engage in this process of word creation. There's all this phenomena that exists, but there isn't a word for it. And the languages are very, you know, it's a living, creative thing. So we should learn how to make up words that express new realities.
You know, last year, our colleague at Planet Money, Greg Rosalsky, he came up with the term skimpflation to describe what happens when the quality of a service goes down, but the price stays the same or goes up. We thought, why don't we put in a good word with Peter at Merriam-Webster?
I'll make a pitch for skimpflation. Maybe that can make it in at a future date.
Absolutely. But again, it's the secret sauce is very simple. Just use the word. You know, if you use the word and then someone quotes you using the word, you know, people will hear it and then others will use it and it just sort of spreads. And then now we've got some evidence and that gets the ball rolling.
All right. So we've got our marching orders, right, Adrian? I want you to use the word skimpflation in like casual conversation at least 10 times a day from now on.
Skimpflation, skimpflation, skimpflation.
No, not like that. You have to like use it in a sentence when you're just like casually talking with like your landlord or like the person down the street or whatever.
Oh, yeah. When you're like, you know, on a date and you're like, so what's your sign, skimpflation?
I don't know if this is going to meet the dictionary's criteria for like proper widespread usage.
Not with that attitude. This episode was produced by Nikki Willett and engineered by Maggie Luthar. Noah Glick checked the facts. VLA is our senior producer. Kate Kincannon edits the show. And The Indicator is a production of NPR.